occupied public domain. I'll suggest that the staff propose a report. But maybe we will tell you successfully one report and deal with others at some other stage. Because if you look at the volume of the documentation given to us by PASA, it suggests that we will be seized with them for quite some time. May I ask if there are any apologies for today in this meeting?
Good morning, honorable members. There are no apologies for this morning. Thank you.
Thank you very much. In welcoming all of you, firstly, I just want to like to deal with few matters of housekeeping so that we are on track in a number of issues that are on our agenda. One is that we are scheduled to go on an oversight trip on public hearings to both Gauteng and Northwest for the 30th and the 31st. Processes are in place, and that we did receive a request from both provinces that people would want us to start, instead of in the morning, they would want us to start in the afternoons because of the availability of the participants, both on the side of the communities as well as the workers, as well as the companies themselves. We have acceded to that request. So therefore, still we will travel on the 29, but then be meeting these, conducting these public hearings on the mining charter on both days, starting from 2 p.m. until late, to allow the space for those communities to adequately address us. The other matter of note is that in relation to the NDFT, that is the Namakwa Development Fund Trust, they did write to us confirming that they have taken the resolutions that we have asked them to take as this portfolio committee, one, to basically say this, that they have resolved to institute a forensic audit. They have also got the board resolution on the replacement of Mr. Losper by the person who was appointed by the Northern Cape government as it was required, and that they are seeking our intervention in terms of their royalties in that the company that has been paying royalties to them, Transhex, has written to the Department of Mineral Resources looking for a directive as to what must they do, because in terms of the newly promulgated Royalties Act, they must pay all monies, all royalties to the South African Receiver of Revenue. Now, what we are considering is to process their request through having small-scale meeting with the Department of Mineral Resources, the provincial government of Northern Cape, just to see in what best manner can they be assisted in terms of a sustainable funding. It could either be the same royalty, it could take another form altogether, because the law is there that all mining companies, in terms of the commodities that they are handling, that they are extracting out of the ground, they must pay royalties to the National Treasury for the benefit of everybody in the country. So we will process that. And in relation to ALESCO Development Fund, you want to comment on that, Honorable Schmidt?
Yes, just on the royalties issue, because as I understood the position, if royalties were payable in terms of an agreement between a mining company and a community, and the Royalty Act then came into operation, both royalties were payable. What is not regulated for is when royalties were not payable before the coming into operation of the royalty bill, and communities are then asking for royalties. So do I understand that position from which we are departing, from which we go forward?
The advisory meeting will be looking precisely at that, because when you look at the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Royalties Act, it does not make provisions. It does not make provisions for that. But when you look at the MPRDA, it guarantees those communities that were receiving royalties. So the intention is therefore to put heads together and say, what then? We also need to look at the commercial arrangement between ALESCO as a private company and this community, you know, and ALESCO's paying the royalties now to the National Treasury. Is that not the abdication of the commitment they made to that community? So we want to put all of that, you know, together. We might find a situation similar to what you are referring to, that they pay both to the state and to that. For instance, there's a very shiny example that we always quote, that of Royal Bafokeng, where there was quite initiatives that were taken by the parties involved, led by the very companies, and then converted those royalties into some form of a stake. So we would need to look at the linkage in terms of that commercial obligation between the two parties. But we believe that we need to put our heads together and then come out with a way forward. It might well be that we don't approach National Treasury at all. We go back to the same company and say to them, look, keep your end of the bargaining. You are right. That will be the issue.
Could I just comment? It's a very important issue, and that is, what, if any, proposals does one make with regards to community and tribal land? Because the biggest problem at this point in time, and I have a complaint on my table at the moment, that's why I'm raising it, and it's a very opportune time. People saying, but this was my land. This was, and under the old dispensation, this was, these royalty or these minerals basically was my entitlement. Now that the new dispensation has kicked in, I've now lost this without any notion of being informed or even knowing about it, and then I'm faced with only the surface rights. And how does one then go forward in terms of, or should one enforce in future, that if mining companies do mine on so-called tribal communal land, what should be the dispensation then, if any? Because that's, I think, part of what one should focus at and whether one should make recommendations in that regard. Because that's a burning issue. A major issue.
Thank you very much, Honorable Lucas.
Yes, I think it's a very serious issue this year, especially in the rural areas where the land belonged to the communities. And I think we should try and see how we're going to face this year, because if the community's only source of survival is going to be taken away, there should be another alternative, whatever happens. So, in my mind, it's a very serious issue.
Thank you very much. I think, indeed, we will be having that meeting. Maybe what we would do, because it will be handled by my office, I may want to invite some of the members serving in this committee, so that when we sit around, look at this, because indeed, the solution we will find for the Namakwa people will extend to other areas. you know, that are confronted with a similar situation, so that you deal with this problem at a national scale, as opposed to just looking at a particular, you know, region or sector of people. So we would then invite some of the honourable members to sit in that meeting. That would be aiming at finding that solution. And indeed, it's quite a vexed question that we need to address up front. Thank you very much. Can you press this thing, please?
What does South Africa say about the wealth of this country in the power of the
so the wealth belongs to the people of the country.
Precisely. Yeah. That's the reason why you have this Royalties Act. Its aim is to compensate the country as a whole for these non-renewable commodities that are extracted out of our land.
That's why the mineral belongs to me, because they are my minerals, because they are in my place. No, belongs to the state, the minerals. Never mind that they are in my land. And that is for the state to compensate me. But all the wealth beneath in the bowels of the earth belongs to the state, not to the owners of that piece of land.
Yeah, no, it is true. The state is the custodian of that mineral wealth on behalf of the country. But the truth is also that we are not affected equally. Those who are living in that land where the minerals are extracted and those who do not reside in that. For instance, the exposure to environmental degradation is not the same for a person who sits in Cape Town and a person who is in somewhere in Limpopo where mining is taking place. Now also, when you look at the regional economies, there are people who depend in terms of their livelihood to those minerals, to the extraction of those minerals in their area. It's a source of livelihood. So as a result, therefore, there have been these arrangements that were done before the enactment of the Royalties Act. So each community, you know, used to have, even after the MPRDA was promulgated, there were these royalties. That's why in the MPRDA, under the transitional arrangement, it is recognized that there have been in existence the royalties and the agreements between the extractors of minerals and the communities from where the minerals are extracted. So our duty, therefore, is to see to it that there is no party that is adversely affected by the promulgation of the Royalties Act. Meanwhile, we keep in terms of the wealth being shared by everybody, you know, in the country. At the same time, we take it. So, in this regard, the dual responsibility of companies is what we will be probing, you know, going forward. But of course, all matters will be considered. Shall we step off this matter? The other issue is that we have an outstanding visit that we need to make to the Schmidt Drift community in Northern Cape. We are going to put in an application. Once again, for the entire committee to revisit the area, the dates we are looking at is the 15 and 16, because there for a meeting to be successful, a community meeting to be successful, we are advised that we must, arrange for it for a Saturday. So, which means the 16th of April will be the date on which we're planning to go and complete our work in the Northern Cape. And the 15th, we would need to have a meeting with the provincial government. The issue at stake here is that after our visit, we were able to then successfully investigate the existence of, once more, the royalties that were supposed to be paid to that community. They are now standing at the tune of 4 million rand. And the company has basically, through our agreement, put that money into a trust fund, waiting to be given a directive in terms of where must they eventually deposit the money. So we took a decision to stop the money from being paid to the CPA because of the challenges that we had been informed by the communities about the CPA. So now our responsibility is to then assist the community to have some form of a governance structure which will take full responsibility of this 4 million rand and that and work on priorities in terms of what people would want the money to be used for, particularly the Smith Drift community. So we're looking at 15 and 16 to undertake that. It is going to depend on the application, whether we get the approval for the entire committee once more, or we get approval for a smaller delegation. It's going to depend. But we are going to put an initial application for the what you call. And I think it's very important that we go and claim the victory of the work that we have done, because it is through our efforts that we are now able to talk of this large sum of money that is accrued, that is accruing to the benefit of that community. So we're looking at those dates. So I think the committee section will make the necessary application that will meet the provincial government on the 15th, and on the 16th we meet the community. Thereafter we come back. That is in April. If there are no comments on that, we would suggest, therefore, that we move on to another matter. Time permitting, we would need to look at the report. Outstanding reports would be the Northern Cape report, some reflection on the IPU resolutions, and also the study tour. That is if time allows us, because we've got very little time between now and those people joining us from I'm looking for this Northern Cape report. The date in that Northern Cape report, it should be somewhere in November. My file is so thick that International Study Tour. Giselle, what happened to my report? The Northern Cape. Have you got it with you there?
Yes.
But mine was marked. It's not in here. it was marked. Can you check it in my office? 2022. Honorable members, then we need to look at this Northern Cape report. Last time we tabled it, and we called for you to read through, analyze, and comment. I trust that you did not have the mishap that I have in my file, where the report that was marked, that is marked, is not in here. But fine, let's talk. Any comments that you would want to render on this Northern Cape report?
Could I just have a copy? Because like you, I'm looking for mine as well.
Whilst we are paging through the report, we have asked the committee section to ask the legal unit to draft a letter of invitation to Alex Court Development Foundation, Mr. Losper, for him to appear before us in April, in our very first meeting in April, which will be after the 8th thereabout. Maybe we'd need to make a follow-up on that, because that would be the first step towards the subpoena in terms of that legal opinion that you've got copies of. We want to deal with the matter on an urgent basis. The letter will have to go to the office of the Speaker, and if it's in conformity with the requirements from the office of the Speaker, it will be dispatched to Mr. Losper. I hope that those people are drafting. So when he's on sick leave, then the work stops. Nobody else there can do work. No, that's fine. But the letter will be dispatched on your behalf, because we can't allow... meeting procedures demand that
they are asking for outside sightings,
so they are messing around. They know they're right. So he says, they are not only from KZN, all over. Gauteng, Mpumalanga.
The reason I responded to this story was from the chief whip's office.
Oh, okay, yeah, no, that's fine. So that was just a point of information that we'll pursue that matter and get to the bottom of it. Did you all now find your Northern Cape reports? I don't know if we will do justice, because pretty soon PASA will be walking in. Should we not maybe... But if there are comments, are they outside already? Okay. let's suspend this, depending on our engagement with PASA, because I don't want them to be kept waiting outside, whereas we've given them the time for them to be here. Let's allow them to walk in and set themselves up, and then we come back to this report after the engagements with PASA. Could that be in order, honorable members? All right. How about this?
Mr. Chika, can I just ask, why is my name included in this report after the words in capital, and? Do I need to infer that I'm normally not in these delegations? Look on the second page. I'd like to know, Mr. Chika. Just look on the second page. He says, due to my importance or due to the fact I never attend the meetings?
Yeah. như mình chia cái một đầu nhé.
Dạ, ý kiến chia thì mấy.
Thầy khen thơ pha ca lạc sáng đại cái kỹ sĩ để ý kiến lượng được lạc bài.
This is the annual report and that's the presentation.
Okay.
Honorable members, ladies and gentlemen, in welcoming PASA, let's just apologize. We're going to be delayed a bit because we're told that the projectors in Parliament have all been taken by other committees that are sitting, and that the committee section had to resort to borrowing a projector far away from here in Belfast. That's how poor Parliament is. It's quite a serious challenge. But in the meantime, let us allow PASA to introduce themselves, and we will introduce ourselves to them so that for ease of reference, we are able to relate to one another. My name is Fred Gona. I am the chairperson of this portfolio committee. Next to me is Teta Mwana.
I'm Milton Doskaka. I'm the committee secretary. Thanks.
Over to you, sir.
My name is Jacinto Rocha, chairperson of the board of PASA.
My name is Ntozami Kifu. I'm the chief executive officer of the Petroleum Agency.
Hello, I'm Olivia Munns. I'm the chief financial officer at Petroleum Agency.
My name is Fuyun Storm. I'm the information services manager at PASA.
I'm Ziggy Van Averbeke. I'm the general manager for promotion.
I'm Jennifer Lart, and I'm manager of Frontier Geology, including unconventional resources.
Let those who are sitting behind come closer to the mic, please.
I'm Lindy Umekwe, Regulation Division General Manager.
Good morning, I'm David Hunter-Spey, Resource Evaluation Manager.
I am Noel Ngabaza, Human Resources Manager, PASA.
Thank you very much. Let's take this honor of honorable members introducing themselves. Spala Mawewa.
Mjali Huipofu.
Biguma Tebe, member of the committee.
Chris Kololo, I'm a member of this committee.
Rob Sondo, a member of this committee.
Lindy Mtobo, a member of the committee.
Eric Lucas, member of the committee.
Hendrik Schmidt, member of the committee.
Eric Marie, also member of the committee.
Good morning, my name is Lisa Mang, CEO,
CNR. My name is Kung Sen Ngobo, researcher for the committee.
Mukasha Pashka Musia, chairperson and CEO, Kaya Lagunya Human Development. Thanks.
Good morning, my name is Johanna Boyson from PMG.
Good morning, I'm Chris Andrews, Secretary to Work.
Sanj Matau from the Energy Portfolio Committee.
Joseph Katanga from the Department of Mineral Resources.
All those against the wall, have you introduced yourself?
I'm Landy Temba from the Department of Energy.
Ivan Kare from Shell.
Thank you very much. We are happy that one of the members of the Portfolio Committee from Energy has already joined us. We are expecting members from that committee because we have agreed that we will sit jointly in listening to the presentation and engaging with PASA. I don't know how far is this projector. Is that the member from the Energy Portfolio Committee? Water and Environment. Please introduce yourself, sir.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Gareth Morgan.
There's a chair here, Honorable Matiba. Matibela, sorry.
We found a way back to the right committee, Mr. Chair.
Get some of them back here, otherwise... Honorable members, can we check, especially for the portfolio committee members from Energy and from Water Affairs, whether you did receive the annual reports and the presentation from PASA? If not, let's equip these members so that they can also be with us in terms of the what you call.
Oh, no.
Scheduled for 11 o'clock whilst we had this problem of setup. It has arrived and it will give you some time to settle. Let's help ourselves to the tea. 5 minutes, please, so that we come back and immediately deal with the subject matter at hand. We must once more apologize to you, Pastor. Otherwise, it's a problem of the shortage of equipment, as we have explained. So, immediately from tea, after 5 minutes, you will take us through. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Honorable members, welcome back. Finally, let's, without further delay, allow Pastor to take us through. Can I check with members that have just joined us whether they do have this documentation? Were you given this documentation? That's great. Pastor, you are addressing a joint portfolio committee which comprises of members of the mineral resources, the chairperson of energy portfolio committee and members of the energy portfolio committee, and there are members who are coming also from water affairs. That is the measure of interest on the matter at hand, and therefore you will be engaged not only by mineral resources, by all of us, as you will be talking to all of us. Over to you, Pastor.
Honorable Chair, honorable members, thank you very much for the opportunity afforded to Pastor to make these presentations today. a number of senior officials of PRASA will make the presentations. But since there is a lot of interest on the shale gas issue, I'm also going to introduce the presentation on shale gas. Over to you, CEO.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honorable Chairperson, respectively, and honorable members of the Mineral Resources and Energy Portfolio Committee, as well as other honorable members that are here from other parliamentary committees, Chairperson of the Board of Directors of the agency, Mr. Jacinto Rocha. I don't know if we do not seem to have any DGs and DDGs of the respective departments, but in case I have not seen one, and other colleagues that are here, on behalf of the Petroleum Agency, I wish to extend our gratitude to the Chairperson for this direct invitation to make these presentations today. The members that I bring from the Petroleum Agency have been introduced, but just very briefly, I just want to repeat that the presentations that you will be hearing today are the presentations on the screen. Because this is our first time to present as the Petroleum Agency, I thought that we should have a full presentation on the operations of the Petroleum Agency and divide up our presentations as follows. One with an overview by myself, the financial report. We have distributed copies of the 2009-2010 report, annual report. We will also follow that up with a specific presentation on the last item that you see on the screen, on our technical data from Mr. Storm, which will be followed by a presentation on the Continental Shelf Claim, which is a special project entrusted by Cabinet to the then Minister of Minerals and Energy, which has been managed and executed by the Petroleum Agency. And last but certainly not least, we will have a shale gas presentation by Jenny Narot. Chairperson, I would just like to establish what the order of questions will be. Will they be after each presentation, or will we make our presentations and then take questions thereafter?
I think for the flow of information, it would be better that you present entirely. Because maybe a question that we will ask might be answered in the next presentation. So we will present entirely and then we open up for engagement.
Thank you, Chairperson, I'd like to begin with a short overview of oil and gas exploration in South Africa and then move on to discuss the agency's role and activities. Oil and gas exploration began in South Africa with the first organized search for hydrocarbons undertaken by the Geological Survey of South Africa in the 1940s. In 1965, SUCOR Pty Ltd was formed by the government and began its research in the onshore areas of the Karoo, Algoa and Zululand basins. In 1967, a new Mining Rights Act was passed and offshore concessions were granted to a number of international companies, including Total, Gulf Oil, Esso, Shell, Arco, CSP, and Superior. This led to the first offshore well being drilled in 1969 and the discovery by Superior of gas in the Platmos Basin. In 1970, SUCO, together with Rand Mines, extended its efforts to the offshore, but despite further encouraging discoveries, international companies gradually withdrew. This was largely as a result of political sanctions against South Africa. Thus, from the mid-1970s to the late 1980s, SUCOR, the state-owned oil and gas exploration company, was the sole explorer operating the entire offshore area of South Africa. Once apartheid ended, the offshore areas were opened to international investors via a licensing round held in 1994. You've probably heard of this term, the licensing round, in the newspapers lately. Our first one was in 1994. In 1999, the Petroleum Agency was established, while in 2001, a new state oil company, Petro SA, was formed through the merger of Sukor and Mosgas. The Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act was passed in 2002 and became operational on the 1st of May 2004. It is in terms of this act that the Petroleum Agency was designated to be the agency that promotes investment in oil and gas operation and the regulation thereof. The mandate of the Petroleum Agency is therefore to be found in the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act, Act 28 of 2002. Our vision as an organization is a viable, sustainable, and responsible upstream industry in South Africa. Our mission, to promote, facilitate, and regulate exploration and sustainable development. As I said, Section 71 of the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act lays out the functions of the Petroleum Agency. I think for the sake of time, I will not go through all of those functions, but they are to be found in Section 71 of the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act. In terms of Section 72(1), subsection 1, the designated agency is to be funded by money appropriated from Parliament. I must just pause here to indicate that this has proved a challenge up to now, because despite the fact that the Act states that the designated agency is to be funded, the challenge that has presented us is that our presentations and submissions to the National Treasury have been turned down, and the apparent reason is that we are not established by an Act of Parliament. And fortunately, the ministerial directive that established us at the time allowed the Petroleum Agency to retain and accumulate reserves, so that at times where there was no royalty, they would be able to sustain themselves. We are therefore able to sustain ourselves in this financial year and the next financial year, but we will have problems, if we still have problems, in the third year with the funding for the Petroleum Agency. We are dealing with the matter, and we have decided to embark, and this has now been approved by the Department of Mineral Resources, by the Minister, to initiate the promulgation of legislation establishing the Petroleum Agency, so that it's a statutorily established entity. Back to the functions of the agency. The agency encourages investment in the oil and gas sector by assessing South Africa's oil and gas resources and presenting these opportunities for exploration to oil and gas exploration and production companies. Our team of geoscientists studies the existing data to identify prospective resources. These are then presented to investors at local and international conferences and exhibitions through direct presentations to exploration companies and through advertisements. Part of our role is to ensure that explorers understand the regulatory regime of our country and to advise government in the formulation of regulations that are in line with international norms. The permit types that we have are the reconnaissance permit, the technical cooperation permit, the exploration right, and the production right. I will come back and describe these in more detail. One of our main objectives is the processing of applications for permits and rights. compliance with all applicable legislation in place regarding applications for and operations under permits and rights, and the need to protect the environment is very important to us. Rights cannot be granted unless we are satisfied with the environmental management plan, while explorers must also prove financial and technical ability to meet the commitments in safeguarding and rehabilitating the environment. The environmental management program process requires public consultation and a clear demonstration that valid concerns were addressed and must satisfy both provincial and national authorities. We have two permits and two rights, as I have said. The reconnaissance permit is as follows. It allows the company to undertake reconnaissance surveys. It's valid for 12 months. Not an exclusive right, not transferable and not renewable. The technical cooperation permit allows for exclusive study of the area. The intention hereof was to allow operators to study existing data without commencing with the expensive exploration operations. This is what is generally referred to as the TCP or technical cooperation permit. The exploration right, of course, is an exclusive right to explore for petroleum. It's an exclusive right to produce petroleum just for testing purposes. It is transferable. You must use it or lose it, and it's for a period of 3 years, which can be extendable in 2 year periods up to three times. In other words, 3, 2, 2, 2 for a total of 9 years. The production right is the exclusive right to produce petroleum. It is transferable. It's for a period of 30 years and it is renewable. The third leg, apart from the promotion and regulation activities, is our data center. The agency acts as the state's archive for all geotechnical data produced through oil and gas exploration. Mr. Phil Yunstorm will make a presentation on our national data center. The issue of location is also an issue that is very important to us and is being a matter of discussion between the two departments as we speak. At present, the agency reports to the Ministry of Mineral Resources, headed by the Honorable Minister Susan Shabangu. This is in terms of the presidential proclamation on the transfer of administration and powers and functions entrusted by legislation to certain cabinet members in terms of Section 97 of the Constitution. This was Proclamation 44 of 2009 in Government Gazette 32367. And the fact that the agency's mandate derives from its designation in terms of the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act, which is administered by the Department of Mineral Resources. So by virtue of this proclamation, and the fact that the Minister of Mineral Resources is the overseer of the administration of that act, and the fact that the Petroleum Agency derives its functions from the act, we therefore fall under mineral resources. However, the agency is currently a subsidiary of SEF Pty Ltd, which is owned by and reports to the Department of Energy, headed by the Honorable Minister Dipuo Peters, and consequently reports in terms of the PFMA through SEF to the Department of Energy. We are advised that our principals, of course, are working together to resolve this distortion through a bill to establish the agency as a statutory body, enabling it to be funded as envisaged in the MPRDA. The issue of funding will also be discussed in the presentation of the Chief Financial Officer. In what follows, I will try to briefly give you some idea of the extent of activity we expect and the potential for upcoming exploration, which may have a significant impact on the country's sources of energy. I will begin with the offshore, where I will describe the current status and the forthcoming expected activity for our license blocks.
Sorry, Mr. Cook.
Yes.
Just back to that slide. Is there any way where we can expand that slide to be readable? Because what is in your package is also in a very small font size. To an extent that with my four eyes it's unreadable. Are you able, through manipulating that machine, to expand the... Is it possible? If not, it's fine.
Okay. Yes, thanks, Chairperson. Unless I can get a technical assistance, no, I'm not able to. But
okay.
Hopefully on the screen, the following slides with the specific areas will be much clearer. New discoveries in the Orange Basin of both oil and gas over the next few years of exploration will play a major role in determining the long-term future of the upstream industry in this area. Petroleum Agency SA is of the opinion that there is great potential for both oil and gas reserves in this basin, and our operators are now on the verge of beginning to investigate the true extent of this potential. Further gas discoveries will provide synergies with planned projects such as that of Forest Exploration International, stimulating the development of new infrastructure for gas transport and building a growing market of gas users. We have 14 companies, including major international oil companies and our own national oil company, PetroSA, and other international and local companies active in 16 concessions and 13 applications. In the northern sector of the Orange Basin, this block is that median line divides our area between us and Namibia. So to the north of the world's median line, that is Namibia, which is where you see Oranjemund and the Kudu gas field, that's Namibia. So this as such is our northernmost block in the Orange Basin. PetroSA is in the final stages of the initial period of the exploration right in this block, that's block one. They have acquired a 1,500 kilometer 3D seismic survey and have now completed processing and interpretation. It is the agency's opinion again that the area may have large potential resources of gas at the same geological level as the Kudu gas field to the north and the Ibubesi gas field to the south, which is in block two. I will get to it just now. As well as in new untested geological plays. We look forward to PetroSA's continuation into the next period of exploration when drilling will begin to test the validity of these ideas. Just to the south of Block 1, we have granted an exploration right to Tombo Petroleum of the United Kingdom after the completion of their technical cooperation permit study. To the west hereof, in Block 2A, that's 2A in blue, Forest Exploration International and its joint venture partners are making good progress with plans to bring the Ibubesi gas field to production, and in doing so, bring natural gas from South Africa's west coast into the national energy mix. Their success will represent a major and extremely important milestone in South Africa's upstream industry. This groundbreaking project will change the general perception of the contribution that natural gas has to offer as a viable long-term energy source for South Africa. Onshore, there has recently been unprecedented interest and exploration activity, largely concerned with unconventional hydrocarbon resources. This interest continues unabated. coal-bed methane exploration is obviously concentrated around the coal-bearing basins in the northeastern part of the country. Major players are mostly smaller indigenous companies, and there are around 25 active exploration rights and many applications in process. In the waterbed coal field of the Elitras Basin, Anglo Operations has drilled over 70 wells and has conducted production tests and has reported reserves greater than 8 trillion cubic feet from their exploration areas. Other operators have drilled over 40 wells. Our own evaluation of the potential resource represented by coal-bed methane is ongoing, and reserves may yet prove to be substantial. The possibility of exploiting methane produced from boreholes drilled during gold exploration is also being investigated, and we are currently processing our first application for an onshore production right applied for by Molopo. Shale gas in the Karoo, probably the most well-known development with regard to unconventional petroleum resources, is the interest developing in deep-seated Central Basin shale gas. This as yet unknown and unproven resource may represent a potentially important contributor to our future energy supply, with current estimates of between 5 to 20 TCF. I will say no more on this one, except to say that dealing with the controversy and that surrounds the exploration technique requiring hydraulic fracturing, as well as public education of the exploration process and of our own role and processes, are some of the many challenges that lie ahead of us. Ms. Jenny Merritt from our team will address this extensively. In order to ensure appropriate governance of the area, this is the area that has sparked the interest in shale gas, the agency proposed a moratorium to preserve acreage which is not covered by any right or permit, as well as any relinquished acreage with the intention of holding license rounds or applications by invitation in accordance with Section 73 of the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act. The moratorium over the Karoo has not been imposed in response to calls to halt all exploration in the area. It is for the purposes of having orderly licensing rounds. For the past 7 years, the agency has managed a major national project that was mandated by Cabinet to the then Minister of Minerals and Energy, who in turn directed the Petroleum Agency to manage the project. Ms. Van Averbeke will present on South Africa's extended shelf claim to the United Nations. The Upstream Training Trust. Besides the core business roles, the agency is involved in corporate social responsibility initiatives, both indirectly through its operators as well as directly through its own programs. Production right holders must put a social and labor plan in place that involves previously marginalized sectors of the population in the benefits flowing from development. These plans are approved and monitored by the agency. The agency also administers the Upstream Training Trust, established in 1997 for the development of specialist skills in the natural sciences, engineering, and technology. This was, as the regulator and the promoter in this field, the agency recognized the dearth and the absence of skills in this field to an extent that a lot of operational people in South Africa are actually people from outside of the country. It was then decided to start this Upstream Training Trust, which encourages students, gives them bursaries to study the natural sciences, with specific focus on the geosciences, engineering, and technology. The trust is administered as a non-profit organization with funds provided by the operators licensed to explore in South Africa. further on CSR programs. The agency has its own CSR program that includes development of skills through internships. We have at all times 5 positions for new graduates, and we employ them as full interns within the company. Staff are also regularly involved in social outreach events, such as house building with Habitat for Humanity. We do this once a year, and it works not only as a team building exercise, but to also and enhance community consciousness amongst our employees. We do this every year with Habitat for Humanity. We have also invested in programs that focus on capacity development, careers, and education. Ladies and gentlemen, honorable members, thank you. I will now give over to Ms. Olivia Munn, our Chief Financial Officer.
Honourable Chairs and Members of the Committees, I thank you for the opportunity to afforded to me to address this combined sitting of the Committees. In looking at the financial position of the agency, I've taken the opportunity to include our forecast figures for the current financial year as the numbers towards the end of 2009-2010 are relatively stale, and I think the trends that are indicated by these numbers are of importance. We need to note the trend of decreasing revenue in the agency as a result of the implementation of the Royalty Act. The agency used to receive its revenue from license fees. That revenue is now being deemed as royalty income in terms of the Royalty Act and now flows directly to the fiscus. And as was mentioned, the MPRDA makes provision for the funding of the agency. Currently, we are still receiving some revenue from unconverted rights in terms of the provisions in the Act that allow for the transitioning of the Act, and that income is likely to complete at the end of this financial year, and our anticipated revenue next year is only 6 million rand. We are currently operating, as you can see, our forecast figure is a loss this year. We've actually started to eat into our reserves that we have, and as you can see in the forecast figures, that the total asset position of the company is starting to decline as we start to eat into our reserves. In 2009-2010, there is an indication of a significant number of 34 million in the asset line, and that is as a result of the fact that currently the final phase of the Continental Shelf claim project has not yet been, we haven't received final funding for that, and the agency in the interim is funding the final 22 million of the phase. We anticipate that there will be solution of to that matter shortly. Right. On the 2009-2010 financial year, we have a situation where the highlights of the year were that we received a clean audit report, and I think that in itself is quite a significant achievement. And during that year, we actually issued our first production rights on the West Coast for the Ibabesi gas field, which actually will see a $4 billion investment over 20 years in the country. The the company was responsible for the submission of two claims for the Continental Shelf Claim Project. This is a matter that will be covered at a later stage, as well as the significant dealing with a significant interest in the shale and unconventional gas. We have improved our systems and are now finding that our applications are being processed timeously, and we have issued user guidelines to facilitate the application process. We continue to see an increasing trend in the number of applications we are receiving as the agency, and a big achievement for the agency in the year was that we received approval by the Minister for the reservation of 20% for BEE in production rights, of which 10% will be allocated to historically disadvantaged South Africans and 10% to PetroSA. And we held a licensing round during the year for the West Coast Deepwater and the Tugela areas, and the successful bidders on that licensing round were Shell and Silver Wave Energy respectively. We expanded our promotional activities into the eastern markets, and we continued with our enhancement and archiving of the data. The major challenges faced around by the agency are the funding of the agency going into the future and the dual reporting through the Department of Energy and Department of Mineral Resources makes it difficult for a targeted process in obtaining funding for the agency. The critical issue around financial side of the agency is the funding. As was mentioned earlier, in 2004, the agency was designated in terms of the MPRDA, and that designation provides for funding from a parliamentary allocation. But at this point in time, the agency has no clarity of how exactly and when this funding will become available to the agency. We are aware that National Treasury requires statutory establishment of the agency for the funding, and we are in the process of obtaining that, as mentioned by the CEO. The dual reporting and the uncertainty about where we are placing in government may affect this process of where we're going. And as I say, our current income will completely terminate in conversion of the old order rights, and we are already in the current financial year beginning to operate off the reserves we have. As a result of the uncertainty on the timing and the nature of the funding that we'll be receiving, the operations of the agency to a certain extent have to be put on hold. We have stopped carrying out surveys to obtain additional data. We have a limitation on when and how to appoint new staff because we don't want to make any commitments until the funding certainty is in place. And we hold back and we limit our operations to the bare minimum to try and limp the funding that we currently have for as long as possible. The final $22 million required to finalize the Extended Continental Shelf Claim Funding project is something that we still need clarity on. And despite all these savings and tightening of our belts, our current reserves will deplete in the 2013-14 financial year. Thank you very much, Honourable Members and Chairs. I'll now hand over to Fulian Storm, who will do the presentation on data.
Honourable Chairs, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to present to you an aspect that I'm very passionate about, and that is our technical data that we are responsible for managing and obviously provide data and keep it alive for future exploration opportunities. The outline of my talk, I will attempt to give you an overview of how critical the technical exploration production data is to our organization.
Please, Mr. Stone, help us to find you. Your slides are not numbered, but we've gone past the one of Nonsigalelo, the one of Jennifer.
Chair, it's stored right towards the end under technical data.
This is the last one.
It seems like it's the last set of slides in the booklet.
Let's navigate through. If you mind, so nice. Summary. Thank you. Okay. Then I'm with you.
Can I continue?
Then I'm with you. Please.
Thank you. I will attempt to give you an overview of how critical the technical exploration production data is to our organization, where it originates from, what legislation exists around the management of technical data, how it is used, stored, managed, and what value does data provide in monetary terms, as well as future value that it provides in terms of its use to attract investment and exploration activities. Existing petroleum data forms the heart, or should I say, the blood of the petroleum agency, and without it, the promotion for and awarding of petroleum exploration production licenses will be a difficult task. It is therefore essential to have the necessary infrastructure in place and undertake projects to improve and retain availability of this valuable asset. Ntozami, our CEO, has already elaborated on the background, but I'm going to try and summarize it again. Exploration for oil and gas started in 1965, when the former state-owned company Sukor started with exploration onshore in the Karoo Basin. The exploration effort shifted to the offshore in the late 60s, where Sukor concentrated mainly on the Bradasso Basin on the south coast, but also drilled some wells on the east and west coast during the period 1970 to 1994. In 1996, a separate unit, the Petroleum Licensing Unit, was established, and all technical and exploration data was transferred to the then called Petroleum Licensing Unit, being a separate division of the old Sukor at that stage. And it was then responsible for the promotion of petroleum exploration opportunities in South Africa. The Minerals and Petroleum Resources Development Act was enacted in 2002, as we all know, with the designation of the Petroleum Agency, SA, being responsible for promotion of oil and gas exploration production. The regulation aspect regarding the receipt, process, and negotiations of permits and rights on behalf of government, then the agency was also designated to become the responsible entity to manage existing technical data, as well as receive, maintain, store, and add value to the petroleum-related technical database. Functions and purpose of this information services department. The agency is therefore responsible for the receipt and loading of new data into the existing technical database, for the physical storage and archive of related petroleum exploration and production database, the maintenance of these databases, maintenance of the infrastructure, systems, and specialized software, and keeping this data alive and available through transcription, scanning, and digitizing services. Clients and interested parties requiring the data for exploration purpose needs to be informed of availability, and in this regard, the agency is responsible for improving systems and infrastructure that supports ease of access to its technical data. On the other hand, it also has to regulate and manage confidentiality, ownership, and entitlement to newly acquired data. PASA also provides the following services to internal and external stakeholders, like permit holders, geoscientists, governmental parastatals, and academia, like access to a small geotechnical library, tape copy and transcription services, and also provides seismic data management services to Namibia and other similar African agency or ministries like Benin, which requested these services from us in the past. We also run a borehole core library with core layout and geological sampling facilities. This slide just summarizes the interdependency of the regulation, promotion and information services departments and external permit holders and service providers on its main asset, its technical data. The promotion division uses these existing data to evaluate the petroleum exploration opportunities and potential, develop prospects that is used for promotional activities. Data is provided to permit holders who uses it for exploration activities and to identify suitable positions for possible wells to be drilled. The regulation division uses the data to negotiate work programs and ensure that permit holders comply with their work program obligations. Each division is responsible for ensuring quality data is received and archived by the Information Services Department, who will have to supply data again at a later stage to permit and right owners. Legislation towards data. All data belongs to the state. Data is kept confidential for a period of 4 years or until relinquishment of the permit or right area. We also need to comply with various legislation regarding the maintenance of data and records, like National Archives Act, Minimum Information Security, Electronic Communication and Transactions Act, Protection of Information Act, Public Access to Information Act. Just a new, or name a few. Exploration well database. During 1965 to 1970, almost 200 onshore wells were drilled in the Karoo Basin. The first offshore well was drilled in 1969. Since then, over 300 wells have been drilled offshore, mainly in the Bredasdorp Basin. Seismic coverage, which is obviously one of our main components of the data. This slide shows the total extent of seismic data acquired offshore and onshore, which covers almost 10,000 onshore kilometers of seismic data. In excess of 300,000 kilometers of offshore seismic data has been acquired. Red areas indicate 3D surveys in the Bredasdorp and in the south, in the south, and orange basins in the west coast. Also shown in some academic data, which is privately owned. The red lines indicate, also on your left-hand side, on the west coast, the non-exclusive seismic surveys acquired by PGS in 2002. I've already covered basically the main types of data. The main categories of data include seismic data and geophysical data in excess of 300,000 kilometers, together with 500 wells and borehole related data, which in today's terms is valued at over $9 billion. This value is based at current rates, acquiring seismic, geophysical data, and drilling of onshore and onshore boreholes. Data standardization. The final data management system that we currently use is petroleum open software compliant. We follow industry best practices and subscribe to various ISO standards regarding standardization on technical data compliance. We prescribe to operators on data standardization and they have to comply with industry specifications. Various international organizations, like the Society of Exploration Geophysicists and another organization, Energistics, set these international standards that we apply to on the submission of data to the agency. I'm not going to elaborate too much on the detail of our information management infrastructure. Our IT infrastructure supports the main objective, namely to manage this valuable technical database and provide the necessary functionality regarding the storage, archive, and efficient supply of data to clients on demand. It also supports an important aspect relating to security, entitlement, and effective access control. Access to data. Clients can obtain access to technical data through a data viewing facility that we offer. We can provide a catalog on available data within a geographical area of interest, and all data is made available under a standard confidentiality agreement contract, which provides for internal access by the operator to the data over a 10-year period. Data can be purchased, and the following general rules apply. Copy cost tariffs apply to permit holders, governmental and local academic institutions, and commercial tariffs apply to non-permit holders and service providers, where prices can range from $100 to $1,000, depending on the type of report and the nature of that report. And then on the seismic data, we make available under commercial tariffs in the order of $10 per kilometer for seismic process data, which is still a very cheap price in industry standards. But our focus is rather to attract and provide data than to chase and ask operators to spend rather money on the exploration effort than to spend it on data. Current projects. Our focus in the technical data side is to improve access to data. Here we need to transcribe, scan, and digitize existing data in order to make it digital available to prospective clients. We also need to build the onshore exploration database regarding available geoscientific data that has been transferred to the Council of Geosciences and other organizations in the past. And that is important to get a better understanding of the petroleum potential of the Karoo and onshore basins. This includes conventional and unconventional gas resources potential. We are currently busy with a project to get all technical data available via web or geographical information systems interface. This will allow quick and controlled access to all available technical data, but requires careful planning, time, access to existing personnel who is already stretched with the provision of data at the present moment to onshore clients and the quality control of existing data. Challenges. The sudden interest that we experience in the onshore areas where data have not been accessed and databases maintained for these data sets created problems when we suddenly had to find and provide data to onshore clients mainly. Data quality and the compliance with industry standards requires careful monitoring. The implementation of an electronic document and management system that was recently implemented to ensure compliance with National Archives Act on other legislation requires buy-in of all personnel, and we are aware change control or change management is not an easy process to manage. The huge volumes of data that needs loading into an online available data management system requires time, resources, and planning to ensure correctness and retrievability. successes. The agency has a good track record for the supply and quality of quality data, since its data is well indexed, cataloged, reports, diagrams, and seismic data is nearline available and can quickly be supplied in required formats. In summary, the agency has a well-organized database, and the majority of data is internally online available, which has demonstrated in the past to be one of the major successes in attracting explorers. It has a good track record in efficient supply of quality data, and the recently established EDRMS system is essential for good record keeping of all records relating to hydrocarbon exploration activities in the future. I thank you. I will hand over to Nsiki van Averbeke, who will give us an overview on the Extended Continental Shelf Plan project. And now,
Honorable Chairs and members of the committee, thank you for giving me this opportunity. I'm going to present to you on the Extended Continental Shelf Claim project, a project that was given to us by the Minister of Minerals and Energy. That's just a cartoon to show you where the area is and the team that was responsible for the submission to the UN. You might want to ask me how this project started and what informed us in the decisions that we took. In the 50s, coastal states were very concerned that there was no law governing what happened in the deep sea. And the concerns they had was that if there was no law governing the deep sea, all the resources that were living under the sea would be exploited by foreign multinationals. And therefore, in 1958, there was a UN convention in Geneva where this matter was discussed. And that convention came up with a definition for the continental shelf. And they defined the continental shelf as the seabed and subsoil adjacent to a coast up to a distance of 200 nautical miles, or as far as it could be exploited. As the members can see, that this definition was open-ended, because again, it left the gap that if it was as far as it could be exploited, then you have the same problem that multinationals could take all the resources of the coastal states. So in 1974, there was another UN conference on the law of the sea. And this culminated in 1982 in the Convention and the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, which is UNCLOS for short. And UNCLOS then gave us a new definition for the continental shelf. And they said in that definition, the continental shelf of a coastal state is the seabed, the subsoil, beyond the territorial sea, throughout the state's natural, the continent's natural prolongation, up to the edge of the continental margin. Or, if there is no such elongation, up to a distance of 200 nautical miles. And they also, in addition to that, defined what they called the extended continental shelf as the area where the natural prolongation of the land extends beyond 200 nautical miles. But then this extension didn't come automatically. You couldn't just claim it automatically. The convention put strict requirements as to how you can claim the extra territory beyond the 200 nautical miles. This cartoon here explains the requirements which are specified in Article 76 of UNCLOS of how a coastal state can go about claiming the extra territory beyond 200 nautical miles up to 350 nautical miles. Now, I've got challenges here because I do not have a pointer. I'll have to stand up. If that is the edge of your landmass, from that low water mark, that is the area that you see when you at low tide, you would measure then 200 nautical miles seaward, and that is what a coastal state can claim automatically. But if you can demonstrate to the convention, the UN convention, that there is a natural prolongation, then they give you requirements that you have to satisfy in order to put your claim. One of the requirements is that you have to look for the foot of your slope. If you look at the continental margin, it's composed of three areas, which is the shelf and the slope and the rise. That is what is called the continental margin. But then legally they call that the continental shelf. Now they're saying if you've got to determine a point which is called, or an area which is called the foot of your slope, and from the foot of your slope, you can measure seaward a distance, foot of slope, plus 60 nautical miles. And that is the area that you can claim extra from your 200 miles. Failing which, you can also claim, you can also base your claim on sediment continuity. And if you claim a distance from the foot of slope, based on sediment continuity, that distance, let's say for argument's sake, you want to claim a further 100 kilometers. At the point, at the end point where you say, I'm claiming, the sediment thickness should be 1% of that distance, which means if you are claiming 100 kilometers or 1,000 kilometers, you're 100 kilometers, then the sediment at that point have to be at least 1 kilometer. Those are the requirements. And then the constraint that they put is that you cannot go further than 350 nautical miles. Or the other constraint is that you can determine that point where your water depth is 2,500 meters, and to that you add 100 nautical miles. Those are the restrictions and the requirements that are given by the convention in order for a state to be able to claim status. So that's what we did.
Madam, I can see the indication here. We don't have the two slides that you have presented in the booklet.
This one?
This one and the previous one.
I beg your pardon.
Yes.
I will provide them.
please do, because they contain quite substantial information. For instance, the one which is talking extensively to the Geneva Conventions, the 1958, the 1973 to 74, is just mentioned here, but it's not explained as you have put it up there in that slide.
Yeah.
Okay.
So now we're going to look at the history of how South Africa then... Okay. Our preparation then for this claim, ANCROSS was adopted in 1982 and South Africa ratified it, I think, in 1997. The Navy and the IMT lobbied for South Africa to start the project, and also in 1997, if I'm not mistaken, the South African Maritime Zones Act was promulgated. And then the cabinet instructed the then Department of Minerals and Energy to take the project further, which is why the minister then instructed the Petroleum Agency to undertake the project. And at that time, $23 million was allocated to the agency to run the project for a period of 4 years. In that period, 2003 to 2010, the first thing we had to do was to understand the principles. What does Article 76 say? Because there were lots of speculation and also interpretations of what we had to do. And we also had to learn how to implement those scientific and technical principles of Article 76. This we did by consultations with experts and also trial and error. So the first thing we had to do was to acquire data, and this we did through surveys that we conducted ourselves. We also used those vessels that were traversing around South Africa. If there was a vessel that was doing an academic survey, we would hitch a ride, basically, and say, can you survey that line for us in order to cut costs? We also negotiated and exchanged data with other countries. We also got academic data and public domain data. We negotiated with our neighbors, which is Namibia and Mozambique, and we also had a cooperation with France regarding the Clove Islands. We compiled the submissions and we lodged them with the United Nations in 2009, and then in 2010, a team from the Petroleum Agency and also from Foreign Affairs went to the United Nations to give a preliminary submission to the plenary of the United Nations Convention. That is the team that submitted, that actually gave the submitted to the plenary. Okay, what is it that we're talking about? You remember that I said every state is entitled to claim up to 200 nautical miles. That is the red line here. What is it that we have claimed? On the East Coast, we managed to claim that area. On the South and East Coast, that is the area that we're claiming. And then we also know that South Africa owns the Prince Edward Island, and our neighbors there on the Clove Island are the French. So that is the area that we claim jointly together with the French. What I would like the members to note is that the boundaries between our neighbors have not been resolved yet. Therefore, the submission that we made to the UN was without prejudice to the later delineation of the boundaries. The boundaries between Mozambique and us
and also this boundary between us and Namibia.
What are the benefits? I'm sure the members didn't know that South Africa was a maritime country. Because what we did there, if our claim is successful, we are claiming for the country an extra territory of 1.8 square million kilometers. We have acquired a comprehensive geophysical and bathymetric data set. We have gained international cooperation, and we have got ongoing relationships with our neighbors, the Mozambique, Namibia, and France. We have managed to grow our expertise and skills, and because of this project, we have a consistently derived digital shoreline. And of course, because of this program, our problems of maritime borders have been highlighted to our principals. That slide just shows you the data that was available on the public domain, that is the bathymetric, the magnetic, and gravity data. Unfortunately, most of it is not good quality, but we did use most of it. And that is the bathymetric data that we managed to acquire, and all that data now resides with the agency. Well, now to talk about the money, I already indicated that before we received 23 million from SEF, and we, from DST, another half a million. And then in 2006, because we could see that we were not going to manage with the money that was allocated to us, we were given a further 19.1 million by SEF. 2009, after doing a further refinement of the budget, we realized that we are going to need another 22 million before we can defend the claim. But unfortunately, this amount hasn't been allocated to us yet. We've been using agency monies, and that money still needs to be given to us by Treasury. Up to 2010, the project has spent about 55.3 million. And the remainder, which is 9.3 million, is supposed to cover the rest of the project. And I've already alluded to the fact that this amount is still under negotiation. The challenges that we're facing, I've explained to the members that through the project we've been able to maintain a very efficient skills base to defend the claim. But unfortunately, the defense may be in 4 to 10 years. How then do we ensure that we have the team intact in time for the defense? The strategies that we have adopted so far is that we have retained a knowledge management consultant who designed for us a knowledge management tool, which is an interactive tool. We thought that instead of putting this in archives where it lies as a dormant document, let's use an interactive process. So all the members who were active in the team were recorded so that if there's a totally new person who has to come in, he can just ask, for instance, how do you calculate the foot of slope? You press a button and it shows you how to calculate that foot of slope. And then we've designed an implementation plan for this management tool. The shortcomings of our strategy is that the strategy will work best if we retain the current skills. Alternatively, we don't know if we can retain the current skills, because I'm sure you have the CFO telling you about the challenges, the financial challenges that we have. Alternatively, consultants can be used, but as all the members know, they come at a price. Just to finish off, some of the members who were involved in the submission. And members, thank you very much.
Thank you, madam. You would also note that the slide that contains challenges
is also omitted from the package. Would you take note of that as well?
Yes, Chair. I will make the whole presentation available to the members.
I think Chairperson Wells, Jen is preparing herself. I know that having read a number of newspapers, listened to news, there is a lot of interest on the issue of shale gas. Now, the presentation that is going to be made will not be about the application. It will be about shale gas in general. At this stage, the agency is not in a position to express a position either for or against the application, because this is still in the process of evaluation. In other words, Shell is dealing with consultation with interested and affected parties. The agency will only really deal with the applications later in this process. So whatever is going to be presented here today is, one can look at the level of the agency acquiring information about Shell gas. So some of them is information that they obtained from documents. Other is information that some officials of the agency acquired in the field when they made a visit to the USA. And this is the basis of the presentation. So it will not be, they may make reference to the Karoo, but it will not be a presentation on what is happening in the Karoo. It will be a presentation on shale gas in general. Thank you very much.
Although I think you've helped us in explaining that part, but we will obviously engage you, as you correctly pointed out, that it is out there in the public domain, and some of our questions will be related to that, not necessarily soliciting your exact opinion, but general knowledge in terms of some of the issues raised by the general public. Over to you, Madam.
Good morning, Honourable Chairs, Honourable Members. It's a pleasure for me to be here this morning to be able to speak to you about shale gas. As you have just heard, the subject has been in the press. There's been a lot spoken about it. I am the manager of Frontier Geology, and as such, I'm responsible for unconventional resources, and that includes the evaluation of resource and also the evaluation of technology related to exploration and production of any such resource. This has been an emotional topic in the press, and today what I would like to do is look at the technical aspects of shale gas, and what I've also tried to do is remove from it the jargon so that we can actually look at what is this phenomenon. Where does it occur? How is it produced? What are the issues that we are likely to encounter? And also maybe just look at some of the contrasts to what you may have heard in the press and some of the ideas that might be around about mitigation and potential actions. So here is my outline. We'll look at the shale gas. I want to look at also what are the benefits of shale gas. We have heard a lot about the negatives, but I think the Petroleum Agency stands very squarely in the middle in this respect. It is an evaluator of the resource. It's mandated to evaluate resource in the state for the state's benefit. It is also required to regulate the explorers. So I think we should be, our aim is to look objectively at the scientific facts and to evaluate the merits and demerits of each case. We will look at where it's found at present, what the special technology is that's needed for shale gas, what are the challenges, and very briefly, without much detail, because you've heard a lot of it already, what is the Petroleum Agency's role? So what is shale gas? I think very simply put, it's a hydrocarbon gas that we get out of a shale. Normally, we get hydrocarbon gases are found within sandstones, and therefore shale gas, both in the manner in which it's reservoired and the manner in which it's produced is unconventional to not what people are used to seeing or people are used, have been or were used to dealing with. Shales are compressed rocks made up of very fine-grained material. They have very low permeability, and they are problem with them is that gas doesn't flow out of them easily. And to get gas out of the shales requires special technology, and this has only recently been developed. It is new technology, and I think in its very newness is a concern for explorers, for regulators, and for communities. I'd just like to explain in terms of this diagram what the difference between a conventional petroleum resource is and an unconventional petroleum resource. Like my colleague, Ms. Van Overbeck, I too don't have a pointer, so I'm going to do just work you around the diagram in words, if that's okay. If you have a look at a conventional resource, it would be produced by the shale. Okay, the purple that you see at the bottom is the shale. That's what produces and is the source for conventional oil and gas, as well as unconventional oil and gas. Conventional gas would be expelled from this shale layer under pressure, so it needs to be buried to depth, then expelled under pressure, under natural pressure, and it would migrate along the browny sandstone layers. It's very light, it's lighter than water, it moves towards the top. So it would continue to move towards the surface and then eventually would get caught in a trap. You can see as it goes up, it's moving up higher and higher. It can't escape. That little red piece that you see at the top there is a hydrocarbon trap. The gas has gotten there and it now can't get out. This is not a very efficient process. It takes a long time and traps are often few and far between. Okay? And this is the restriction on conventional oil and gas. So why looking for oil and gas is such an expensive business, because your chances of finding these small traps is quite small. So, however, with shale gas, this goes directly to the source. Your shale is a continuous layer. It already exists. Your gas is contained within it. And an unconventional resource is one that is reservoired within the material that actually sources it. So what you would do is we ignore the geological process of expulsion and migration and trapping. You go directly down to the source of the gas, the reservoir of the gas, and then you apply the pressure that's required to expel it into a created permeability and porosity, and then you extract it to the surface. This is usually happens at depth, often between 1.5 to 6 kilometers deep. And because it's so, your gas is so tightly tied up in the rock itself, it requires these new techniques to produce it. And these two are horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing. But those are words that obviously bring all the press stories back to mind. And I would like to talk a little bit about what are the benefits that we see and why are people interested in an unconventional resource? If it has these problems associated with it, why are people still interested in it? Well, I spoke about the uncertainty of finding hydrocarbon traps. Gas shales are found throughout the world. They are continuous, and usually they can produce gas. They usually have gas by nature of their development. They usually have gas entrapped within them and associated with them. And this has opened up potentially large resources that can provide energy security to countries maybe that would not have conventional resources. The benefits that we know is gas is a cleaner energy source than coal. South Africa is heavily reliant on coal, and on a coal that is relatively 30. Okay, it has quite a high, has quite high associated minerals and elements with it. Carbon emissions are up to 50% lower than coal related in carbon emissions. It's also much lower in other pollutants. So I think this is why people have focused on gas so much, is because it is seen as a greener energy source. Gas power stations, gas is also considered as a foundation fuel for renewable energy sources. Wind and solar can often be quite unreliable. You are dependent on the external source to create that energy. Gas power stations, unlike coal power stations, can actually be switched on and off. So you can store the gas, you can switch it on when you need it, and you can switch it off when you don't need it. So what people see as have called gas in these large quantities as a transition fuel towards renewable energy, and also as a foundation fuel for once your renewables are coming online, you can actually control them with a foundation fuel. In South Africa, we have a limited infrastructure, and it's thought that a resource like this could be a driver for both industry and infrastructure. If we have a look now at where shale gas is found, shale gas and the interest in shale gas started in the United States about 20 years ago. It was in the 1980s. If you look at this map, and I don't know how clear it is for the rest of you, but if you look at this map, this gives an indication of the United States shale gas plays. And in the States, shale gas has been a scenario changer. There are a number of things that have come about as a result of their discovery and their ability to produce the gas. If we look at it, that says 1,860 TCF, which stands for trillion cubic feet of gas. And that says gas IIP, which stands for gas initially in place. This is an almost an unimaginable number. It's also an invisible number on this slide. And as I say, the effects have been dramatic. It has reduced the United States' dependence on liquefied natural gas. They import a large amount of LNG. It has also, for the first time, delinked the price of gas from the price of oil. And this is quite a major eventuality. It hasn't happened before. If we look at where people are exploring for shale gas at the moment, in addition to the United States and Canada, there's also a concentration of exploration within the United, within Europe itself. Here, there are countries like Poland, Romania, Holland are looking at shale gas. Also, developing countries such as China, India, and Russia have large potential resources of shale gas. And in 2002, there was a focus has moved into South Africa, and I would like to look at the situation here as well, briefly. You've already heard about this area when the CEO was giving his overview. But if we look at this map, you will see outlined in grey, that's no way I can do that, is the outline of the Karoo Basin. It covers 90%, almost 90% of, 60% of South Africa's land mass, and it's a huge area, and it's under this southern part of the area, which amounts to 250,000 square kilometers, is the area in the southern Cape, in the southern Karoo Basin, which is prospective for shale gas. 250,000 square kilometers is a huge area. This entire area is underlain by the shale formation, which is considered to be prospective for shale gas. That is the White Hill Formation, and it ranges in thickness from approximately 10 meters to 70 meters. The maps are not here, but that is quite a vast extent. So, there is potential for this resource to be huge. And we say that it's a potential because the main point that we need to make clear is that without exploration, it is impossible to evaluate the resource. Numbers have been calculated on the basis of analog basins elsewhere, and the most conservative figures that have come forward have been 5 TCF. Okay, that's 5 trillion cubic standard cubic feet of gas. That compared to 1,860 in the United States doesn't sound a lot, but it is 5 times more than Moss Gas was approved to develop. Moss Gas had 1 TCF, this is 5 TCF as a conservative estimate. The upper limit is, in the words of one of my colleagues, up to your imagination, because we have no upper limit figures. People talk about 25 trillion cubic feet. People talk about 49 trillion cubic feet of gas. Those cases need to be evaluated because there you have an energy mix changes for South Africa. One is not saying that that is the case. I think what we're saying is as the agency mandated to evaluate the resource, we need to look at that resource and the effects that it might have on South Africa's energy mix. It cannot be ignored. But until shale gas is not a geological resource, it's a production resource, and it is limited by the quality of the shale, the quality of the gas, is limited by the economic factors that are linked to production. So, having said that, I'm going to go back to what is the special technology that is required for shale gas? Okay, horizontal drilling. What you look at in this little cartoon, you can see that a normal conventional reservoir can be reduced with a vertical well. For shale gas, what has been developed is horizontal drilling. You will drill a vertical well bore till a kickoff point. Once you reach your prospective horizon, you start to drill horizontally. The reason for this is it allows maximum exposure of your drill well to your formation, and also it allows more than one well to be drilled from the same position, requiring a reduced number of drill pads. The second is hydraulic fracturing. This is the process by which water is pumped down a well under pressure and it fractures the shale. The fractures allow the gas to shale out of the sandstone, allow the gas to flow out of the shale as though it were a sandstone. But I think let's look at the process. It's more than just hydraulic fracturing. There's more involved in the process of drilling and producing shale gas. So here is, in this cartoon, the entire process is laid out. You would start by drilling the borehole. You would drill vertically. You would turn the well horizontally when you reach the prospective layer, and you would drill horizontally. The distances there, you can drill as deep as 6,000 meters. You might drill horizontally for another 6,000 meters. So it is a very long borehole. In an area such as the Karoo, it is arid, there isn't water available for process. This process does require water. It is called hydraulic fracturing. It requires water to be pumped into the well. Therefore, you would need to bring the water into the area. This water would be pumped together with a mixture, so mixture of sand and chemicals. So if we look at it, there's about approximately 99.5% water and sand, and then about 0.5% chemicals would be mixed together. This would be injected into the well under pressure. It would fracture the formation and create fractures up. The sand would be forced into these fractures, which is what holds them open, because otherwise at 6,000 meters, that is going to collapse and close down again. So what you're doing is creating a conventional reservoir within the fractures to allow the gas to escape out of the shale into those fractures, back into the borehole, and out to the surface. In order for that to happen, the water has to be removed from the fractures, from the borehole, and taken out of the well. This recovered water is then stored in sealed open pits. What's meant by that is they seal the base of the pits, they store the water there, and it is then removed, either reused in future fracks, or it's removed to treatment plants where it can be recycled. The natural gas, meanwhile, comes out. It's stored in storage tanks, and then it is sent off to, it's piped to the markets. I have some figures here which I took off a website called Energy in Depth, and I put them up here just as not as a supporting. They're not our result. They're not the results of our research, which we are busy with, but they are reports that have been done by the United States Environmental Protection Agency, the Groundwater Protection Council, and the Interstate Oil and Gas Compact Commission. And they put out reports in the 90s, which have all found that hydraulic fracturing is non-threatening to the environment or to public health. U.S. operators frack 35,000 wells per year. And at the moment, there is no proven record of contamination through fracking. It's not to say that contamination does not happen, but it's not necessarily through fracking. As I say, we are in the process of doing our own research. We are setting up projects to work with the Water Commission. We are setting up projects to work with the United States. The States has been working on this for 20 years. A lot was done through trial and error. I have and believe they made mistakes. We are hoping that if we are ever put in this position, that we won't make the same mistakes they make, that we can learn from their experience, both in evaluating the risks and in their mitigation. So let's look at the issues and the concerns, and legitimate concerns that are raised by concerned the public, by the regulator, and by the explorers. And I think there are a number of challenges. The first and the most obvious one is environmental, but there are economic challenges as well. There are also infrastructural challenges. I think that if we look at... I lost my place. So I'm going to look at a number of different aspects of the environmental challenges that we've heard about and that we are researching in a fair amount of depth. I think it's important to state at this point that the agency, in fact South Africa, is at the forefront when it comes to issuing licenses for exploration. We are one of the few countries that requires an environmental management program before a license is provided. In many countries, the government provides a license and then asks for an environmental management program. And I think the whole thing about an environmental management program is that it sets the stage for a very healthy dialogue and debate and an inspection of the issues that are concerned. That the EMP actually is not the final or the end result. In fact, if a license is issued, every well is subject and every invasive, land invasive activity is subject to a site-specific environmental impact assessment. So the environmental plan, I think, and I understand to be corrected here, merely gives the framework within which these processes will be managed. So let's look at the issues that have been raised. And the first one is the one about the contamination of groundwater and potable aquifers. I believe, in my personal capacity, that it is unlikely that groundwater would be contaminated by the fracturing process. If we look at this well, here, if we look at Exhibit 30, casing zones and cement programs, what you'll notice there is that every well that is drilled and every borehole that is drilled, whether it is vertical or horizontal, is drilled. You drill a big wide hole, and then you cement in a casing, and then you drill a thinner hole, and you cement in casing. So as you proceed down your well, you are cementing in steel casing to produce, not only to protect the surrounding rocks, but also to create a system which is closed. You cannot remove gas out of a rock if you don't have a closed system. So it's very important for the development of gas that your system is closed and that there's not an escape into the formation. You will see in this example that there are three sets of casing. And at the level of your potable aquifers, which are at the top 100 to 300 meters, there is a lot of casing in your borehole. Where contamination can happen is if your compliance regulation is not good. Because if you lose well integrity, then you can get contamination. If your casing is not properly cemented in a well, you can lose gas into your aquifers. However, if you have a well drilled to standards that are set, and industry standards are exceptionally high, then your formation and your aquifers are safe. It's very important that explorers are capable of drilling with the best technology and have the economic resources to do it as sustainably as possible. You must insist on strict compliance. So I don't think that groundwater is at risk. You want a closed system. You want the gas to come out. You do not want it to escape into the formation. Fracturing is a highly expensive process. It's only done in order to facilitate and is restricted to the formation from which you wish to draw the gas. And well-cemented protective casing will protect your aquifers. And I think it's important that that reassurance is given because, as I say, it's what I believe. But that's not the only challenge. There are other challenges. What about the surface footprint? We are aware, and it is known, that shale gas development requires the drilling of many wells because you have a very impermeable formation layer. You need to be able to extract gas from those layers. So if we look at a picture like this, then I ask you, is this what we want in the Karoo? And I think that our answer would be no. I do not think that we wish to look at a landscape that looks like this. And I think what I was saying earlier about horizontal drilling and the ability to drill horizontally from a single pad can mitigate this kind of landscape. It can also, I think, if you are obliged to a site-specific environmental impact assessment, one can assess and control this kind of development. Until we know how large the resource is, until we know what the porosity and permeability is, we cannot predict what the development profile will look like. There are other concerns that fracking at depth is going to make the surface unstable. We were recently in Texas. We are on an intensive campaign for research in order to research the technology and the issues. And this is an image taken at Fort Worth, at Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. And you can see in the background is an airplane. It's actually landing on a runway, which has been drilled. There's a horizontal drilling beneath that, and it has been fractured underneath that. They run airplanes at one-minute intervals that land on this runway. The surface of the Earth is not affected by fracking at 6 kilometers. What you see here in the foreground is a wellhead that is producing gas from these wells. The drilling program and process is large. It is noisy. It does have many issues concerned with it. The wellhead itself is small. It has a very small footprint. This can continue to develop gas to the system, produce gas, for decades. I think most conventional wells run for a number for maybe of tens of years. These can run for 20, 30, 40 years and produce gas from your shale. Other issues, noise and traffic. And I think these are associated with any mining activity. There will be noise and traffic. A lot of development in the United States has taken place within highly populated areas within suburbia, and they have developed systems whereby soundproof walls can be installed. And basically, this process has a limited time span. It's 2 to 3 months, after which the well will look like what we've seen, and it can produce gas quietly for decades. But I think the really big issue, and the one that we're all concerned about, is the issue of water use. This is particularly significant for the arid Karoo, and I think it's a legitimate concern. And I think every player needs to deal with it with the gravitas that it requires and that it deserves. It won't go away if we don't think about it, and it won't go away if we don't face it head on and look at what might be ways of developing and working sustainably with water. I think it's important as well to look at what these figures mean. For instance, in the Marcellus Shale, this is a open pit from the United States. It's an image from the United States of an open pit in the Marcellus Shale. This is, as you can see, it's lined with what you can see in front here. The black is the plastic that lines this pit. This is waiting for refracking. And the figures that we're looking at, to drill one well in the Marcellus Shale requires 100,000 gallons to drill, or 5.5 million gallons to frack the well. That equivalent, that total equivalent for a well, is 21 million liters. It is a large figure. It's a lot of water. It's the equivalent of 8.5 Olympic-sized swimming pools. It's also 1 month's water use for a golf course. And I think I'm not trying to minimize the concern with water. I think it's important that when we talk about these numbers, that we think about them, because that's what will provide the basis for how we manage the problem. It's not about that anyone's ignoring it. I think what's looking for is, are there means of managing what might be a problem for a resource that might have to be exploited? So the questions that will be asked and that have to be answered is, how will explorers deal with this problem? Where is the water going to come from? How will you get it to the Karoo? And what are you going to do with it afterwards? And it's only answers that are part of the management program that are sustainable and that are acceptable that can be considered. I don't want to go into this. The agency can only respond to the environmental issues when they are lodged with the agency, and they need to look at them factually. But I think, if I speak for myself, those would be the questions that I would ask. In the States, there's a great move towards the recycling of fracturing water. 25%, 25%.
Madam,
am I running out of time?
Can we request you to pick up speed?
Yes, I will go on. I'm nearly finished, actually. Okay, so you can use salty water, and it can be recycled. So the challenges I think that we need to look at is the economic challenges. I've spoken a lot about the environmental issues and the fact that there needs to be ecological mitigation. This is very expensive. And if it's expensive, it requires the financial resources and the technological resources to deal with it. South Africa lacks an infrastructure. The industry is in its infancy. We do not have pipelines. We do not have service providers. We don't have analytical laboratories. In the United States, the price of gas was an economic stimulus to the industry. It was only when it shot up in response to many factors that the production became economic. Therefore, the gas price in South Africa needs to be set. So, briefly, what is our role? We need to evaluate, promote, and regulate the oil and gas exploitation for benefit of all South Africans. That means, yes, we need to evaluate the resource. Two, we need to regulate it. The objectives of the MPRDA are that all developments must be environmentally and ecologically sustainable. This stands within the text of the Act that mandates our activities. Ecologically unsound developments must not be allowed. The agency intends to use a calm and objective consideration of both sides of the issue. And it needs to be a measured approach which is based on factual evidence which does not disadvantage one side over the other. So basically that's it. Shale gas is recovered from shale with the use of recently developed technology. It's led to massive reevaluation of the world's energy resources. We might have huge shale gas reserves in the Karoo, but without exploration we won't know. This could help South Africa change its energy mix and profile, but it could be logistically difficult and costly. Don't think groundwater pollution is likely to occur. However, scarce water resources are the ultimate challenge for any Karoo shale gas. And the Petroleum Agency has the mandate to promote and regulate ecologically sustainable hydrocarbon for the benefit of all South Africans. Thank you. And I'm sorry that my enthusiasm for my subject took me a little longer than I anticipated. Are there any questions?
Thank you very much. Honorable members, it's quite a mouthful in terms of the information that you have absorbed. And we will open it for questions from whatever presenter that has presented, so that we don't confine it to one particular presenter. Let me see some hands for noting. I note Honorable Freiling, Honorable... Honorable, is that Morgan? Let me just note here. Let's see. Freiling, Morgan, Hololu, Lucas, Schmidt, Sonto. Is that all? Is that all, honorable members? Okay. Then it will come back to us here at the table, starting with my co-chairperson. All right. Shoot, honorable Freiling.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for the presentation. It is interesting to hear.
Just before you ask the question, can we get the status of this annual report? There was a feeling from the committee section that it was not tabled in terms of the procedures in Parliament. Was that done? or have you just prepared it and sent it through to us?
Chair, it was tabled at to the Portfolio Committee of Energies with the CEF Group.
Oh.
When the CEF Group did it as our holding company.
That's good. No, that's good. Thank you very much. Over to you, Honourable Colleague.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Yes, and it was a very interesting presentation hearing about the work that PASA does. I mean, it is interesting to me to note that you are a separate agency that looks at oil and gas, whereas you've still got the Department of Energy that licenses other mineral resources. So, I mean, one could question, particularly in light of the kinds of revenue problems that you are speaking of and where that fits in, that we might need to look at rationalizing that approach. But I suppose the preferential review on state-owned entities might come up with some recommendations in that regard, but we'll wait to see what happens. I mean, my major interest here is, in fact, as I think a lot of people do, is around the shale gas, and obviously that's generated a lot of media, but it's also generated a lot of concern amongst residents of the Karoo. Now, I agree with the statement that shale gas could be a game changer in terms of the energy mix of South Africa, but I think that the contamination of the water resources of the Karoo could be an even bigger game changer for this country. I mean, water is our most precious resource, and so we have to adopt a precautionary principle. And in that regard, my complaint here, or my feeling is that PASA's mission, as you state, is to promote, facilitate, and regulate exploration. Okay, so that is your major mission. Whereas, you know, where is the Environmental Department in all of this? And because the MPRDA Amendment Act hasn't been put into operation, and so we haven't seen environmental authorizations being taken over by environmental affairs, you are sitting with that particular priority at the moment. And clearly, you know, and the presentation you've given here, you are clearly saying we need to be looking at this, we need to be finding ways of exploiting the shale gas reserve. So we just need to make sure that the integrity of this process in terms of making sure our groundwater doesn't get contaminated is properly respected in that regard. So I'm interested to hear how you're working with the Department of Environmental Affairs, as the final decision won't just rest with you, and Environmental Affairs will play a huge part in determining whether we should go ahead with this or not. And just on that particular thing, that some of the concerns that have been raised is particularly that this fracking is occurring at a huge depth, at a depth which I don't think fracking has occurred at before. And I'm just interested to hear what your research has to say on that, because it seems to be experimental fracking in that regard. The other thing that you mentioned but you didn't talk about enough was the wastewater that comes out of it. An article that I've read in the New York Times has said that a number of wastewater treatment plants cannot handle the wastewater that comes from fracking, and the levels of radiation in the water surrounding them have in fact increased. So I'm just interested to hear what you have to say in terms of dealing with wastewater. And then also, do you not think that we should do a proper study first of the aquifers in the Karoo? We need to fully understand the geology of the Karoo, because we don't know what will happen to that shell when you start to frack it, and whether in fact some of those chemicals might come up. We need to understand that thoroughly before we in fact start to give out licenses. And then just lastly, I hear that your licensing round is you said that there's going to be 3 licensing rounds before the end of 2012. Can you just give us some clarity on what that is and what that means? Because I've heard it reported in the media.
Thank you very much, Honourable Morgan.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. My interest is also in the shale gas, and I have a number of questions which I would like to ask on that. The first question is, there is no sort of policy on hydraulic fracturing in South Africa, and the MPRDA says that the applicant can demonstrate technical ability. Now, how can you reassure us that PASA itself has the ability to actually assess the environmental management plan and everything that goes into the exploration application? You're a small agency. You've said that you have problems with funding yourself. What technical ability do you have to actually assess this plan and determine whether it is acceptable and that you can apply your mind to everything that you need to apply your mind to? Then it is hugely problematic, I believe, but I mean it's the complexity of the law that we work under, that you are both the promoter of gas exploration in South Africa. You are obliged to accept the gas exploration application. And then you adjudicate on them, and you give a recommendation on whether to go, whether exploration right can be approved or not. I mean, the problem with that is that you promote and you determine who gets it. You'll probably tell me, well, that's how the law works, but it goes together with the fact that, I mean, who is actually watching PASA? When you've got an obligation to promote and an obligation to award. Then, with regards to the size of applications, I'm not going into the merits of any particular one, Mr. Chairperson. They've broadly matched that map of where you said there might be exploitable reserves. But these are exceptionally large areas which cover significant parts of South Africa. And there could be any number of drill sites in those areas. Why did you decide to allow, I mean, have such big applications, actually, or to accept that? The reason I say is that as a member of parliament, I'm concerned with things like spatial planning by from Trevor Mann, Mr. Minister Manuel, the rural development green paper coming up, the national water resources strategy. You're effectively becoming the land use management determiner of large areas of South Africa. And we haven't even finished spatial planning in South Africa. And that is deeply, deeply problematic. And in line with that, why did you declare the moratorium on new applications? What has spooked you in this entire process that you need a moratorium on new applications? Then you say, the other thing is, why is it not possible to demand information on drilling sites up front and then do a full EIA at the start? I mean, you have thousands of farmers in the Karoo who are rightly perturbed that they're going to do, that people are going to drill on their farm. And everyone is actually very, very nervous about it. And linked to that, what stops an applicant who wins an exploration right from turning it into that image where you show the patchwork, a huge amount of actual drilling wells? I mean, hypothetically, let's say an applicant says, I commit to only drilling 6 wells if you give me the exploration right in this area. What stops them from not drilling 50 wells or 100 wells? What is that limitation? And then my last significant point, Chairperson, is you say, well, you're looking into doing research and all of those kinds of things. And you say, well, there's research that says non-threatening to the environment. And you're well aware of the fact that Congress in America has commissioned this report from the Environmental Protection Agency. Granted, there's a need to try and exploit lower carbon fuels and all the like. But in my point of view, when a country which has been drilling for decades more than we have, their highest decision-making body expresses a concern and says, let's at least look at the link between hydraulic fracturing and drinking water, that actually we should also express caution and say, hold on, you know, let's find out what is going on here. And then my last point is that it worries me actually that PASA even presented some of the views on fracking today as the group that has to adjudicate on this, in the sense of the noise and look at this and, you know, the views of that it's possibly non-threatening to the environment, because you actually have to adjudicate on this. I mean, you've already shown me an inherent bias in your presentation today towards a particular procedure. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Khulalo.
Thank you very much, Chair. I've got a set of questions here with me, but I won't ask for all of them because there are too many. The first one, actually, Chair, will be on the waste management of the drilling and fracturing. In fact, I wanted to find out as to what do you do with the debris that you drill and fracture the rocks underneath. Do you sell that to the construction companies or do you use the waste actually to rehabilitate the drillings that you usually that you go deep, then you have to fill in those wells. Do you take that debris to rehabilitate, or what do you do with the waste? I don't know if my question is clear on that one. The second one would be on the economic side of the shale gas, regarding the pipeline that you spoke about, on the challenges that you don't have enough pipeline. You mentioned that there is a lack of pipelines, and then my question would be, what about the pipeline that Eskom is currently going to put up? Because I know that there is that big pipeline that is going to be transporting fuel, it's going to be also transporting a gas, in as far as I know, Chairperson. That would be the second one. The third one, Chair, would be on the Prince South African Extended Continental Shelf Claim Project on the Prince Edward Island. I did not know about that. It's very, very interesting. I'm happy that you are here today sharing this information with us. I just wanted to find out if that Prince Edward Island, is it a sort of an island, are there people living in there, or is it for exploration purposes, or what mineral resources actually exist in that thing, in that island? And then the other one, Chair, will be on your collaboration with the... Are you working hand in glove with the geosciences? Because to me it sounds like they are also doing exploration, by the way. Is there anywhere where you meet, actually, where you work together? And then the last one, Chair, you said that PASA was not promulgated by the Act of Parliament. How is it that the location is under the Ministry of Mineral Resources? Let me ask those for now, Chair. I'll come with the second bite. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Lucas.
To look at other means of energy, and I think if we take it from that point of view, we should look at it. However, there are very serious issues about environment and water, and all these must be taken into account. I'd ask about the offshore drilling. What progress have we made thus far? Is it promising, the investment? Is there return for the investment in the offshore drilling? And then when you go to the shale issue, I think it's very important for us to look at it and see it. We've heard the presentation. But have you got sufficient? What's the quantity in there? You might start something which won't, the life of the gas that you'll find will not return the investment. So I think we need to look at this, get exploration results before one could go forward. I've also very, when you talk about the Karoo, the first thing that strikes you is water. What are we going to do about that? It's very serious. Just recently, over Christmas, when I was driving home to Durban, over the news it said, bring water to carry, if you can even carry 5 liters of water and drop in that area. So water is a serious issue. I think we need to bear that in mind. I've been looking at this, and I've been very excited at the technology from that point of view of drilling and casing it and drawing out whatever gas is it. Now, and fracturing the shale. Now, I'm not sure how the gas is. Have you to fracture the shale before you take out the gas, or is it lying? Is it lying in there? I'm not too sure about that because it's not mine. Profession, and then you draw it out. Do you have to have a pump at the top to extract it, or does gas naturally come to the surface? We'd have to look, because if that's the case, it is important to know how much you have in the reserve, because what will happen, it will just come to a dead end. You won't have the force pushing it up to the surface. So I think we need to really look at this thing very thoroughly before we start
saying yay or nay. And the biggest concern is the availability of finance. And I think for any investor, they have to know a bit more, because investors will not just come and invest blindly. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few issues to raise. The one is, and I'll start from the back of the presentation, it deals with the shale gas issue. You make an interesting observation saying in the United States it was when the price of gas shot up that production became economic. It infers that the cost will be expensive in extracting gas. What has been the experience in the United States? Has it been, you say it's been delinked. Has it been delinked because it's more expensive? Is it cheaper? What is the expected impact, if you could? But what's the real impact in the United States economy? The second issue, a lot of talk is about water. Any possibility of seawater being used? Because that appears to be the next logical question. The third issue is the 23 million rand to which is referred to, I think in the presentation regarding the clause, I think the UN clause. What happened to the 23 million rand, I believe, is still awaiting, which indicates to me, and I think some comment has been made, that the agency in itself financially is questionable. And then, of course, when that becomes questionable, the ability to monitor, effectively monitor, and to effectively conduct studies, and to effectively say, I'm in a position to evaluate a fracking mechanism when the finances is dubious, becomes an issue. So, and I know, and that brings me to the next point, because you're saying it all depends on what National Treasury says, and my, and the base of my application for funding is based on whether I'm statutory organization or not. But then my question is, I do not recall vividly, at least, you appearing before this portfolio committee, even when it was DME. It might have been in a somewhat different fashion, but as I said to you, I can't recall you appearing before DME portfolio committee, neither the Mineral Resources Company, and it might have been, you know, that I didn't attend. But is that to do with the fact that you have not been a statutory organization and reported indirectly to the minister and not directly to the committee? Because we did raise it with the Director General a few times and asked the question to who does PASA report to? And the question was a bit to here and a bit to there, a bit to DMR and a bit to, you know, what is the cause for you not having reported on your annual statements and your reports as you should have, as I would have expected to be? Then the last issue comes to the more, in my view, the most important issue from where I sit, and that is, you make an interesting remark regarding the, and it says 2009-2010 highlights. I'm not sure from this presentation, but I think it was from the first presentation. But it says approval by Minister for reservation of 20% BE for production rights. That's fine. Then the point I question is 10% HDSA, which is fine, 10% PetroSA. Does that mean that PetroSA as a state entity will receive preferential treatment? Because if so, we already had the assurance that the state-owned mining company will not receive preferential treatment. Now, if we were to believe anything which the minister says or government says with regard to state-owned mining company, if this is to say that by virtue of PetroSA being a state-owned entity, you are receiving 10% preferential treatment, if that is what it says, then what reason is there to base that, to accept the minister's point of view that we will not allow state-owned mining company, which is still under presidential review project? How can we then argue that if that is so, it won't apply? Then have you been consulted anyway with regards to the new, your new so-called dispensation within the biggest state-owned mining company? Because that is an issue which is still not finalized yet and is being investigated. It's being siphoned off from the CEF group of companies to a long-standing company, and are you expected to form part of that state-owned mining company where it will inter alia have assets belonging to different sections of, let's call it, sectors of the mineral resources of which the state has the ownership? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Sondo.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think let me follow those members who are saying that it is good for a country to explore alternative sources of energy. But we need to interrogate the processes leading to that in a way that would not be a loss to the country. My first question relating to the shale gas, I would want to understand the historical origin of this gas, of this resource, in fact, and the countries. I heard about America, and countries where this exploration and use of this energy resource was successful, or the lifespan thereof. Following that, we've heard that, Jefferson, there is a view that Karoo has got this energy resource. Exploration is not clear about the reserves that we have there. If, say, for instance, we can be appraised on what sort of reserves, the lifespan of the reserves that we might be having in the Karoo, and this fracturing will forgive us on these terms. Perhaps we will not be pronouncing them correctly. This fracturing plant, hydraulic or otherwise, where do you contemplate to put it up, and why? I was looking at that at the slide that has got a plane on the what's name on the runway. Now, when you are drilling vertically and horizontally, yes, definitely you are propping up the holes that you are making. But what happens to those holes? How long do they live after you have extracted the resource? Are they becoming just wild mice holes that live on the what's name? On the soil or something like that. Then the other one, where there's a bear on top of something that I don't know. I want to understand that. Oh, it's on top of Hiroshima or Fukushima. the last bullet point, gas power stations can be switched on and off more easily, useful foundation fuel for development of renewable, but unreliable. I want to understand that unreliable. This useful alternative gas that is that should be explored, which is cleaner than the other carbon-emitting energy resources. Why should we venture into it if it is unreliable? If I understand that sentence, I might not understand that sentence. It might relate to wind and solar. Then the last one, The last one, Chairperson, is relates to I don't know how should I craft this one, but I want to check the skills needed in the process of this exploration of this energy resource, and whether we will be able to retain those skills given the young age of the agency. I hope I'm putting it correctly. The last one, when I was jumping onto the sea, I was wondering, Chairperson, and I wanted to ask that question long ago, when the presenter was presenting, that we talk about continents here. So see, you were talking about continents, and I was not sure in terms of the United Nations conventions and whatever, how many continents are we talking about? Because as this slide is pointing, it's pointing to our own continent, which is Africa South. And before this experience or this experiment was ventured into, what was the state of affairs of our marine standing as a country? Now, I wanted to check with you whether the lines that you are talking about there relating to to shelf areas, whether it tells us that you hear sometimes people saying that you are in South African territorial waters. Does it relate to that? And if it does, what do you mean when you say we have gained some meters, some marine meters in terms of our territorial waters or something like that? I just wanted to understand that. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Oh, Chair. I'm rather, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Rather uneasy. I'm looking at the time and I've got an equally long list of questions. You give the leadership. I just felt I'll hit a few and I would propose the rest should be just submitted in writing, because this is a very, very, key issue, particularly when it comes to exploring and looking at, alternative forms of energy supply for South Africa. However, I would like to pick up a few areas. One is the policy, legal and regulatory framework. Can PASA tell us whether they feel that there's adequate policy, legal and regulatory framework for them to operate? Let alone the fact that there's no legislation for their existence, but I got a bit anxious when the earlier inputs, were indicating as if PASA is already giving out right and center for full exploration and production of gas in the Karoo. That's what triggered my mind, that for your operations, do you feel that there's enough? The emphasis and the bias is obviously on the shale gas in particular. Linked to that, to what extent have you engaged in interdepartmental collaboration? The various departments that are either affected or could be stakeholders around shale gas in particular. And
the other area is consultation with stakeholders generally, including private sector and civil society vis-a-vis sensitive issues. Another area is the how much are you sharing expertise and information with global players in shale gas in particular? I've got a specific question, Chair, for the presenter on shale gas. Reference was made that the quality of coal in South Africa is relatively dirty. I have anecdotal information that globally, countries are hungry for the South African coal because of its quality. Obviously, at my position, I need to get factual information. So if I could be given reference where I can get, information exactly as to what exactly is the state of affairs, at what level is the quality of the coal in South Africa? Around privately owned data, I think something was made around that. I got rather uneasy. When you talk about energy in any country, you're talking about politics. And once there's privately owned data around this issue, some of us get rather jittery. What I'm interested in what way is data collected privately? And how is that area regulated? I think the last point here is more of a comment. Through your leadership, can we really get a full report and general plans a little bit more in detail around the shale gas? There's a weakness in PowerPoint presentation, because even the earlier questions to me left me a little bit dazed, because I thought PASA had presented in this way, but the question seems to be interpreting PASA's presentation in a different direction. That's my motivation, Of course, that's after this meeting. If really some more detailed information can be shared with us, Tabulela.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. The challenge is time. We've lost some time in the morning, and also we've seemingly underestimated the importance of your presentation. It generated quite a lot of interest. I also have a set of questions. Now, I think we need to enter into some arrangement, following up on what the Chairperson has suggested, that before we close our deliberations on all state-owned entities' reports, maybe the date we are looking at is the 23rd, am I correct? If you cannot come back, if it is possible for you, I think we must pose that question directly. If it is not possible for you to revert back to us, but also the emphasis should be on this shale gas matter, which seemed to be an issue that has generated a lot of interest. I got also a set of questions around that. Hence, we said earlier on that whilst you reserve your position in terms of delving a lot into that matter, because you still have to adjudicate over the applications that have been made, but the interest is out there. But also, we are impressed in terms of the amount of work that you have done so far. Given the fact that this is the first time of a real engagement with yourself, in fact, we are sitting with an asset in you that we're not aware of, let alone the challenges that are being raised. But the important matter is that you are putting the country in a better position to can be able to develop this alternative gas or energy supply. Of course, with the challenges that goes with it, because this kind of energy could be said to be clean, could be said to be also not harmful
per se in the, on the environment, but the same is being said about nuclear. Look at what is happening in Japan currently. That is a result of the natural occurrence there. Indeed, those people are in real danger in terms of, you know, the nuclear establishment in that country. So therefore, that's why I'm saying that we need some time with you so that we can understand clearly what are the potentials, both good and also negative. And I think you've touched on the matter. When we look at your financial status, you know, standing, we see that you are in a quite healthy situation currently, but you are flagging the fact that going forward there would be challenges. We would want to understand the status of your discussions with the Ministry of DMR and also, you know, National Treasury. You would know, Mr. Chairperson, that National Treasury is not keen to open its purse, especially when they see that there are some reserves in a particular entity. They are quite reluctant to can be able to then agree on funding unless a business case has been properly made and that there has been an agreement. And also we want to understand how far is this either amendment in terms of the MPRDA that will properly establish you, or a complete new constitutive act which will make you an entity that is established in terms of the statute, so that therefore you stand in line. So I'm saying, therefore, I'm just flagging these questions. There are quite a number of them. You spoke about the social and labor plans in your report, CEO. Indeed, we would want to understand more in terms of how are those getting, you know, monitored in terms of its implementation. Because our own experience as Mineral Resources Portfolio Committee, even on mining, when we went out there to assess the impact of the legislative framework, including the social and labor plans, we were found wanting in terms of either the existence of the social and labor plans or the implementation thereof. So I'm coming back to my earlier question. Are you amenable to granting us some more time of interaction with yourselves within a very, very short space of time, namely on the 23rd? You're going to answer on all of the other questions. I think members will have to stick it out. We're eating into your lunchtime. But at least for responses, you would have to listen. But I'm just posing this question.
Chairperson, we say yes. We don't. When a body like this one invites us to come back, we will come back. We won't say no. Because the more we share information, the more it gets clear in your minds, and the more trust is created. And I'm going trying to answer some of the questions. The agency came here today with no position on shale gas. What the agency attempted to share with the committee is what they've been reading. The application by Shell was lodged in December 2010. They have to submit a draft environmental management plan in April. From April, the PASA will consult with other state departments, water affairs, environmental affairs, in order for them to participate in that process. So what PASA is doing now at this stage in relation to this application is waiting for Shell to come back to it. So it is neither a position for nor a position against. What Ms. Merritt was presenting is what she has been reading. And in some instances, she has expressed her views on as an expert, because one has to consider that as an expert, she must be placed in a position where she's also able to present views. Now, how does application processing happen in PASA? The officials, the representatives of PASA, evaluate the application. The board of PASA has a technical committee.
that after the PASA managers have evaluated, expressed a view, and expressed a recommendation, the technical committee of the board re-evaluates the same application and express their own views on that application. Now, that committee has geologists as people who know issues around petroleum. From the committee, it then goes to the board. At the board level, once again, it is debated, it is discussed, and a conclusion is arrived at as to which recommendation to make to the minister, whether it is a yes or a no, and then it goes to the minister. So this is, in summary, the process. So the issue of bias doesn't even arise. It was a theoretical and hypothetical presentation that was made. It was not dealing with the facts of the application by Shell, because they have none. They don't have any facts other than what all of us have heard through the media, the concerns that people are raising. Now, these concerns will assist us in also evaluating the application when it is presented before us, because then we'll be able to start asking questions. For instance, if the water issue becomes so insurmountable, it can be one of the reasons to say no. So the concerns are there. It does not mean that PASA will not be able to respond to the issues when they are presented. As to the status of PASA, PASA has been designated by an act of parliament. So it is there, an institution that is recognized in terms of an act of parliament. Now, the debate between National Treasury, the DMR, and DOE was that it has been standard practice that you establish an institution in terms of an act of parliament. So there must be an establishment legislation. Now, the reason why PASA was not established in the same way that the others were was because at that time, 10 years ago, there was not so much activity around oil and gas in South Africa. So when we then established, we were of the view then that says, let's create this institution and see what its future is going to be. Now that we know that there is a lot more activity, there is a lot more potential, then this is when one will start now thinking about, can we not establish statutorily this organization? Pre-2004, there were no applications for shale gas. There were no applications for methane gas. Now there is. So one can then start considering as to whether to establish separately the PASA. So PASA is not an unlawful body. I think let the committee know it is not an unlawful body. It has been the MPRDA allows the minister to designate an organ of state. PASA is an organ of state. It has been designated. So in terms of law, it does exist. The difference is it's just people see it as an anomaly because it has not been established in terms of an act of parliament that says the section so-and-so hereby establish this institution to be called the Petroleum Agency of South Africa. This is the difference that is there. On the matter of 10% of PetroSA, it is very difficult for the officials of PASA to respond to this because it is a political decision. And what PASA has to do is to implement that political decision. One thing that I can say is there is a big difference between state-owned mining company and the state oil company. Unless there is a future decision in government that says they are going to bring together the state-owned mining company and state oil company, this is future. It is not a matter that the PASA will be able to deal with it now. Our political heads will decide. And if they decide that PetroSA and the state-owned mining company will be merged, this is what will happen. And the officials of PASA will have to deal with it at that stage. At this stage, PASA does not have a position to indicate us to which way it is going to go. And I think I can present to the Portfolio Committee with confidence that whatever decision PASA will recommend to the minister around shale gas, it will be a decision that will be compliant with the law. Because this is the instrument in terms of which PASA is required to regulate the sector, irrespective of whether there is confusion between promotion and regulation. This is what the law says. They promote on one side and they regulate on one side. And they've been doing that without any problem. So at this stage, PASA cannot run away from the fact that in terms of an act of parliament, they are required to perform these two functions. And this is how they are going to operate, irrespective of the views that one may hold for or against it. Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. Perhaps let me start by agreeing with my Chairperson, Mr. Rocha, that we will certainly come back at a date and time that is set by the by this body. We will liaise with Ms. Kaka for an appropriate date. So we will certainly be back as required. We have also noted the question. Perhaps we will also attempt to prepare our next presentation or our next meeting with a full view, with the view of answering in full the questions as we have noted. We will go away and share. I don't know if these proceedings are being taped at all, but we will attempt to share our notes to ensure that all the questions are answered. Perhaps before, I'm going to ask my colleagues to assist with the number of questions. Are we at a point now where we should go through the list, Chairperson?
Yes, please.
Okay, we will do that. Perhaps let me start with the general questions. I will come back to the more specific questions on shale gas. I think on the general side, Mr. Rocha has answered some of the questions about our operational framework. The one question that was raised by Mr. Hululu had to do with our collaboration with other bodies, especially the Council for Geoscience. Yes, we certainly do collaborate with the Council for Geoscience. As a matter of fact, the CEO of the Council for Geoscience is one of our directors. That's Mr. Tibidi Ramuncha. And quite apart from that, we do share information, naturally also because, just for example, when you look at issues like coalbed methane, the department regulates the exploitation of coal, and we regulate and take applications for the exploitation of methane. Now, that means that for all data that relates to that, as we do our research with regard to the gas, we necessarily have to have access to data on coal as well, and vice versa. So we do collaborate. We will collaborate on other projects as well, such as the carbon capture initiative. We give a lot of input. We serve on the board with the Council for Geoscience. Perhaps from there, let me proceed to say as well that the assessment process necessitates our contact with the various state departments, with the Department of Environmental Affairs, Department of Water Affairs, even with the Department of Science and Technology. For example, one of the questions has been the astrological facility, the SKA. So we certainly do collaborate with all of them, and as part of the assessment of the EMPs, we solicit their input before we make our own decisions. We solicit their input and we interact with them. So generally all the assessment of all EMPs goes through that process, and this one certainly will have to need that rigorous process, including the water affairs and relevant bodies. And then the promulgation by an act of parliament, as I said, the chairperson has addressed that. We were not necessarily established per statute, although the establishment directive, of course, was based on the SEF Act at the time, and was established under the SEF Act. But the designation itself came under NPRDA, and this was followed by a gazetted establishment notice by the then Minister of Minerals and Energy, which was, I think, on the 8th of June in 2004. Still on the general question, Mr. Rocha has spoken about the 10% state and 10% federal SA. I won't go much into that. Just to correct a little perhaps conception, it's not 20% BEE per se. It's a 10% state and 10% BEE. Now, if the state's stake, if the state's 10%, that will be operated by the National Oil Company, which is Petro SA, and we do force the operators at production to have a 10% BEE. So the operator at production must know that they can only have up to 80%. Some countries have bigger state stakes, but we are not a well-endowed state, so we have to be very humble. At best, we wanted to come as close as possible to the to the hard rock minerals and mining charter, but it's very difficult. We are not as endowed on the oil and gas field as we are on the hard rock minerals. So this is about as far as we could go. The even Petro SA as the state's NOC would buy into that right, although they would not be held responsible for the prior exploration costs. But going forward, they would foot their full bill as an actor with regard to production costs. Still on the general question, skills needed in the process. Sorry, this was the question from the Honorable Sondo. Skills needed in the process of exploration. This is definitely a challenge. We do not have many geophysicists, petroleum geologists in the country, and I'm not talking race, I'm talking full stop, period. Geoscientists, we do not have them in the country. And as the petroleum agency, and as led by the department, that is why we felt it necessary to have that upstream training trust to say to the operators, we want you to contribute towards a fund that you will also, and a trust that you will also sit in ensuring that there is a fund set aside to encourage skills development and training in these geosciences. Of course, we have to start with as early as possible with encouraging natural sciences from matric upwards, because you can't just have, fund people for masters in geoscience when you have not encouraged the natural sciences at a younger age. In encouraging this again, as I said, we've got internship positions for the geosciences, through which we have taken a number of young people, although we don't hold them, we don't tie them to the agency. We've got a number that have succeeded and passed their masters, and others are proceeding to PhD level in the market today in the geosciences. So yes, it is a problem. It's a problem that we're dealing with even internally within the petroleum agency. We've got young people that are training, and our organogram is structured such that we've got people in training, because some of our more experienced and older scientists are quite close to retirement. Perhaps within the next 6 years, you might not see some of us that are geoscientists. So it is a problem, certainly. The the next question, okay, let me continue with the general one. The adequate legal and regulatory framework that Honorable Chairperson Jigelana raised, I think that was answered by the Chairperson. Interdepartmental collaboration from Honorable Jigelana was also answered by myself and the Chairperson. I must say, though, that the second part of the question had to do with the extent to which we interact with other stakeholders, like community-based organizations and so on. We do not. What we interact with is state organs and state departments. The assessment process necessitates that applicants must conduct consultation meetings with all interested and affected parties. We do not do that ourselves. Of course, we do, at the acceptance of an application, put out a notice that says we have received an application, we put out the parameters, and we say to all who sees the notice, if you've got any issues to raise with this application that we have received, please raise them within a period of 30 days, after which we then force the applicant to go and conduct the meetings with all interested and affected parties. Now, just to contextualize, this is what is happening with the Shell application at this stage. This is what is happening with the Falcon Oil application at this stage. They are busy with that consultation, hence all the commentary that is in the newspapers today. Collaboration globally, yes, we do collaborate globally. We interact with other scientists, both through a number of organizations, AAPG, and others. In fact, some of your members will know that in 2005, South Africa hosted the World Petroleum Congress. This is through our collaboration and as members in South Africa of the World Petroleum Congress. We've got our own South African National Committee. So we do collaborate both in terms of documentation, both in terms of research that has been done, as was evidenced by Jenny's presentation. Privately owned data, how is it collected privately, and how is this regulated? I think, as Falun stated, data belongs to the state. The manner in which it is privately collected is that we are able to give a license to a particular operator for data collection for a particular time. And for that particular time, in order to protect the investment and the cost that they have incurred, that data will then be protected and not be available to other operators. It will always be state data, but it will be protected so that others do not ride on the back of somebody else's research, which is quite costly. Research and data collection, especially offshore, is extremely expensive. And then with regard to the Honorable Chairperson Ghana, we have noted and are quite grateful to the comments that you've made about the work that this organization is doing. And yes, we are trying to do as much as we can within the means that we have. And yes, we've noted that we will need PASA to come back. With regard to the status of the amendment of the NPRDA, perhaps I can give to the General Manager for Regulation, Ms. Lindiwe Nekwe, to comment.
Just before she does that, I'm getting some indications from honorable members. Because I know that at 2 we must be in the house, and I want to put a proposal that the remainder of the questions, as they are noted, we deal with them when they come back on the 23rd. I don't want to stop you because I know when you are in the house, you are going to be there because there's legislation that we're going to be dealing with there. I take it that this is a great one. But then on the 23rd, we will start at 9 instead of 10, so that we are able to devote at least 2 hours of that day to this subject, an hour or two to this subject matter, and then deal with the other matters that were set aside for that particular day. If there's going to be a change in that date, the CEO will be contacted tomorrow if we foresee some challenges on that particular date. It might mean, honorable members, we may be compelled to look at a Friday for us to complete this work, because it will give us enough time to can be able to engage properly and indeed deal with it. So please be flexible. But you will be contacted by the committee secretary and your committee secretary from Energy, and to basically. But we must agree now when do we schedule this. Thank you very much. The meeting stands adjourned.
Okay, thank you.